Well, welcome, everybody. It's an honor and privilege to be here in this seat, sharing my reflections on practice with you in a slightly new way. One teacher who says, "Nervousness is just awareness sparkling through your constructs." I'm going to go with that. If I start to drift or go soft, if somebody in the back could let me know that, I'll try to keep the volume up. And I'd like to really encourage you tonight, as you listen to the talk, to participate with me fully in this talk. So by that I mean continue to meditate while you're listening. So not necessarily with your eyes closed, but with a good deal of your attention still rooted, grounded in your body, aware of your breathing, aware of sensations, and maybe if you use sound as an object, receiving the words and the accompaniment in the background. In an open way, so it's not just a passive listening, but you're fully here, using this as part of the meditation. And in many ways, you already have been participating with me in bringing this talk into being, because I wanted to speak about Sangha, community, and what it means to really take refuge in Sangha, what it means to be on a path of practice together, what it means to be awakening together. And as I've held this kind of open question, it's as though every conversation that I've had, one-on-one and in interviews and in small groups with many of you, it's as though everything's come forward to speak to this question of what it means to be awakening together. So already feels as though the Sangha is simply speaking back to itself. I was listening to a talk in which the teacher said, you know, no matter how it appears, you are not a solitary experience. You were created, formed, and produced in someone else's body. And that phrase just really reverberated with me. I know often when I come in here on Tuesdays, I can come in very preoccupied with my busyness from the day. And I sit down, and as I start to settle, there's often quite a bit of wonder at the fact that I can sit with about 100 other people quietly, who also value silence, and really inquire about what it means to be alive, what it means to be awake. And this always brings up quite a bit of wonder for me, that we have this chance to practice together, and that the fact that we're here rests on the efforts and actions and good intentions of so many other people, that we didn't just arrive here in a vacuum, that Seattle Insight actually began from a seed group, a small group of people with a shared intention to practice and commitment to practice. And from there, the dedication and hard work of so many people, of Rodney and Ellen, amazing number of volunteers and board members and people who've granted support, who now contribute to our capacity to sit. So we're not in this alone. This is not a solitary endeavor. And just as we're here, there are groups throughout the country, throughout the world, who are also committed in their own ways to this practice. So it's part of a much larger shared commitment and shared endeavor. So this is one way of welcoming ourselves here, welcoming ourselves in. And I'd like to start with a text from the Dhammapada that speaks to refuge. They go to many a refuge, to mountains, forests, parks, trees, and shrines, people threatened with danger. That's not the secure refuge. That's not the supreme refuge. That's not the refuge, having gone to which you gain release from all suffering and stress. But when, having gone for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, you see with right discernment the Four Noble Truths, stress, the cause of stress, the transcending of stress, and the Noble Eightfold Path, the way to the stilling of stress, that's the secure refuge. That the supreme refuge. That is the refuge, having gone to which you gain release from all suffering and stress. So the first thing that always occurs to me when I read this passage is that refuge is quite an active thing. It's not something to which we pledge our allegiance or our undying commitment and blind faith and then are granted immunity from all bad things. But refuge is something, it's more of a heartfelt intention that allows us to see more clearly, that deepens understanding. So it's part of the conditions with which we're able to see clearly. And at the heart of this taking refuge, I think, are the questions, what really matters, what's truly, truly important and of value, and where do I place my trust, what's truly trustworthy. And these aren't simply Buddhist questions, but Buddhists traditionally take refuge in the triple gem or the triple jewel. And in ancient times, jewels were thought not only to be extremely valuable and precious and radiant, but also to have an indestructible quality and to serve as a protector. So the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha is where we traditionally go for refuge. We can go as part of a formal ceremony, if a monk or a nun is ordained, or simply to mark a lifelong commitment to this path. We also do this often at the beginning of retreat. Some people chant this daily. But it also has this immediate aspect to it. So there are external and internal qualities of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Hope I don't run out of water. The external qualities are meant to give rise and to ignite the internal. So the external quality of the Buddha is the historical figure, the human being who lived in a particular time and place and committed himself to discovering the truth and to transforming his life. And this is meant to give rise to an immediate capacity in ourselves to awaken. And the Dhamma, the teachings that he laid out, the path of practice that's meant to ignite in us each and every moment the capacity to use each circumstance as a potential opportunity for practice. So each moment can be an opportunity that we can work with to deepen understanding. And the Sangha has a few different meanings. Conventionally, it's meant to mean the monastic sangha, so monks and nuns, the community that was established at the time of the Buddha that through various lineages have allowed the teachings to carry forward to the present day. And another meaning of sangha is the noble, it's called the noble sangha. So those people, men and women, lay and ordained, who have attained some degree of liberating insight, so some degree of understanding into the way things are, so they can be real models for us in their behavior. And then many Western teachers use Sangha in this just to mean the community of practitioners. So those of us just bumbling along with a strong intention to practice together. So this can also be an extreme support. So I thought I would speak about Sangha because often it's kind of the underdog of the Triple Gem. I think we can get very focused on the Buddha and our own particular individual path to awakening. But often, as I mentioned in the beginning, we can kind of forget our context. We can forget the human aspect that we are in this together and affecting one another. And to remember that can be an extreme motivation, inspiration to practice. So the first question is, when we take refuge, is what are we taking refuge from? So refuge from what? In the text it said, those go for refuge who are threatened with danger. So when we're in fear. And I was speaking with my father's neurologist a little while ago. He's been ill for many years, and I was explaining to him how overwhelming it is to have a neurologist, a urologist, a cardiologist, a speech therapist, a physiatrist, and a primary care doctor, and so on and so on, just all of these specialists. And he said, you know, aging is like being in a boat that continues to spring leaks. You spring a leak somewhere and plug it up, and lo and behold, you spring a leak somewhere else. So then you have to plug that up, and then it leaks somewhere else. And he said, eventually the boat's going down. And this is all we can do. So I thought this was really interesting. But it is the condition that we find ourselves in, and to some degree, to more or less degree, we know this. And there's an extreme uncertainty when we can start to touch the real fragility of being in a human form. I learned also that panic is trademarked. The word has been trademarked. So as I was preparing for the talk and thinking about taking refuge, I received a catalog from a conference center. They hold workshops and retreats. And this particular workshop was designed to address the primary symptoms of illness that each of us can encounter that are becoming more and more common in everyday life. And so these are pain, anxiety, nausea, insomnia, constipation, and exhaustion. So it's actually PANIC, but the acronym PANIC has actually been trademarked. So to some degree, we're experiencing this uncertainty at various levels of our body-mind. And this is what we live with, and this is what we seek refuge from. So where do we go to try to create solidity or try to get a sense of safety? I don't think we need to meditate for very long before we begin to see all of the ways in which we try to make ourselves safe and secure. So we each have our favorite versions of trying to shore up a sense of ground for ourselves. So in the text it mentions going to mountains and trees and shrines and parks, and that actually sounds like a very benign form of going to refuge. I think our distractions at this point are quite a bit more destructive often than that. But those two are means of escape. So sooner or later, we realize that what we have been counting on for security is not secure. That what we look for consistency is not actually holding up. So whether that be a status or a job, relationship, a family, whatever we're going to give us this sense of ground, we find sooner or later is not holding up. So we look for something else. And at this point, usually, if we're beginning to meditate and we're first coming to practice, we need a lot of support because we're moving from what societally and culturally everything is telling us will give us safety and security. And we're making this turn to look directly at that discomfort. So this takes quite a lot of support from other people, not only in the beginning, but actually all the way through. We need this initial inspiration to practice and support. So when we sit in a group of people, we find ourselves able to stay and to hold things that alone we may not be able to. So Narayan often says, peer pressure can be a really good thing, especially if you have wise peers. So we let the relational field of the group hold us for quite a while, probably all the way through. And we start to realize that another orientation is possible. We see people who have been committed to practice perhaps for longer than we have, or who embody it in a certain way, and we learn from that. So this is the whole phenomenon now that's getting so much publicity of mirror neurons. So if we have any degree of empathy and attentiveness when we see somebody else performing in a certain way, an action, our brain responds as though we were actually the ones performing that action. So we literally learn directly from one another what's possible, and our brain rewires itself. And as we start to speak with one another and form spiritual friendships, which is really at the base of the community, and small groups and one-on-one, we get a very concrete understanding that we all share the same general circuitry and hardware. That the fear and panic and spinning mind that seems so personal and so much our individual problem, we really experience as being part of the shared human condition, part of the shared human predicament. So it's no longer just personal dysfunction, but it's part of this condition. So I often will say to myself, when something's challenging, every human being alive feels some version of this. Or others too have faced this same mind. Others have faced this mind. And it gives me, things can get a little bit wider and it becomes much less personal. So, as I mentioned, my father's been ill for many years, and at one point, when I was feeling particularly tired, when the tenant said to me, "You know, Carrie, we're all holding this with you." And she just said it in passing, and it was the simplest thing. And all of a sudden, it was like just a little bit more space and ease in the situation, something I had continued to try to hold and take responsibility for. I could just let go just a little bit. So our circle can widen in this way. Of course, it's not always good news being in a relationship with other people. We also get a very clear reflection of where we're stuck and where we have more work to do. And you don't actually need other practitioners to show you this, but it's helpful. So I know early on in my practice, as I began sitting, I began in a training that was long periods of silent sitting, going very deeply into the body. It was quite solitary, not a lot of time for interviews or dialogue. And well, this is a very important part of my practice, and a lot of spaciousness opened up. Coming out of retreat was extremely painful. So really within an hour or so of being invited to come back into conversation, any vastness and sense of space that I had experienced shriveled down into about the size of a raisin. So I had this experience of going from vastness to raisin, and vastness to raisin, many, many times, going from solitary practice into relationship again. So not only did I not know that this is a very common experience, I didn't know that that was trustworthy, the contraction expansion, but I also didn't know that my mindfulness didn't have a strength and solidity yet, a pliability that allowed me to withstand all of the grasping that came up in relationship, all of that strength of conditioning that would come forward just from being with other people. So Gregory Kramer, in the work of Insight Dialogue, many of you know about and have practiced, he talks a lot about how the self is formed in relationship, and so this needs to be an important part of our practice. And the strength of these, what he calls interpersonal hungers, so the kind of grasping that comes up specifically in relationship to other people, can be quite strong. So I know I made a very firm commitment to develop a practice that could move in between those two, in between solitary and relationship, so full engagement, so it could find full expression. So all along the way, the external Sangha ignites the internal. And the internal aspects of Sangha are our capacity to be increasingly harmless and generous with one another. So it's these open qualities of heart that the external Sangha can bring forth and inspire in us. And so that even when we are alone and supposedly solitary, we have a sense not only that we are in this kind of shared commitment with other people, but we also get a sense that something in us is starting to become more undefended. So we get a very real feeling of a heart that's more relaxed and at ease. So even when we're not with others, there's a feeling of the Sangha having been internalized. And so we can start to relax, and we get a sense that we are in something trustworthy. There's a bit more trust for this process. And we are part of a community of which values turning towards the difficult. It's not oriented towards performance and success and achievement. It holds in its value this kind of openness and honesty. So our heart can relax. There are a couple moments in the Buddha's life that I've heard explained in a slightly different way lately that have been very inspiring to me and point back to this level of our humanness and our relatedness. And one is at the point at which the Buddha was undertaking ascetic practices and was achieving high levels of concentration and was quite successful, but his body was completely emaciated and he was starving and realized at some point that he was about to die, that his body was completely weak and malnourished, and occurred to him that maybe there is a better way. At this point, the woman came and made this offering of milk rice to him, rice porridge. And he took the offering and he took nourishment, and this allowed him to continue on in his practice and increased his focus and concentration and allowed him to continue to go deeper and to sit with strong determination. And I think this is an interesting moment. Kivisaro and Tanisara, two teachers who were with Ajahn Chah, who now teach in South Africa, have interpreted this moment as being a moment at which not only the Buddha discovered the middle way between between nihilism and indulgence, but also in deeply honoring the human form. So in really committing to awakening in a human form and committing to accepting the offering of another human being. So fully accepting his humanity in that moment. And it was near this time that he had this memory of being a young boy sitting underneath a tree on his father's land, outside with the family in the distance. And it was just a very simple memory of being completely at ease in his body and with his surroundings. And so it was also this memory that allowed him to make this turn and instead of denying and striving to transcend the body, to turn and say, is there something here that I can accept? Are there resources here that I can actually use? Is there an easier, more simple way? So it began from something very, very human. In the text, the Buddha is often referred to as a physician who's dispensing medicine. And the medicine is the Dhamma, or the teachings. And Stephen Batchelor talks about this and saying, so if the Buddha is the physician and the Dhamma is the medicine, it's meant to cure us from suffering, then the Sangha is like the nursing staff who's dispensing the medicine. So not something just meant to cover over our symptoms, but something really meant to get at the root of why we suffer. So most of us can relate, I think, to some degree, to the sense of striving that the Buddha began with and is trying to overcome limitation. So most of us start with natural ease with our humanness and see that as a resource. So many of us are motivated by a sense of lack, especially in the very beginning. But this can persist actually all the way through, that we come to practice with a very fundamental feeling that there's something in us that's flawed, that needs to be fixed, that we just have to get over or make right. And this is a whole nother talk, but just this gnawing feeling of lack. And it's amazing, speaking in groups with people, how many of us share this and how long it persists. This feeling that we're not measuring up to some standard, or we just can't quite get it right. So it's as though when we first concluded our separateness very early on, we took some sort of blame for that and concluded that there was something the matter with us, that we felt so separate and apart. So instead, what we can come back to is, or what we can start from, is this natural ease that is our, that we each have as potential. This natural ease in the human body, in the human form. So Ajahn Suchito, Bonnie actually referenced this in her talks. He has this series on the natural mind, pointing back to our innate potential for sanity, for clarity, for a basic sense of trust and ease that we can tap back into at any moment, but that we're just not accustomed to recognizing. So he says, before one gets too involved with meditating, just check out. Is there basic trust, basic warmth, benevolence, goodwill, basic clarity? When it isn't there, everything we do in meditation is ego-based, trying to make ourselves okay, trying to get there, trying to get it right, feeling you're not getting it right, getting frustrated, trying thing after thing, pushing on it, crunching it down, collapsing because something isn't right. And there's nothing wrong with the technique per se, it's just that we're not starting from the right place. So I would say that there also isn't anything wrong with us from the beginning, it's just that we don't start from this place of natural ease, natural mind. So the part of us in our body that naturally moves towards homeostasis, that knows when it's out of balance and when it's in balance. And a key part of this is the natural empathy of heart. So a natural goodness of heart. That when we're not preoccupied with our own defense, we can tap into. And this is really the key, or the key for this capacity to be harmless and be generous in the world, is this natural open-heartedness. So the nature of the heart mind, or the citta, is to resonate. So that's just what it does. It receives sense impressions and it resonates. So much like the bell, when you strike it, just resonates with sound. It's continually affected by whatever's around it. So whatever sight, sound, person, memory, it's just vibrating and resonating with whatever's around it. It's extremely intimate and extremely sensitive. And the closer that we get to this, the more we can feel how sensitive we are to other people and our surroundings. We're continually being affected and affecting others. And so if we can come back to what's really at the base of our humanity, which is this need we all have to be safe. So the organism is wired around this fundamental need for safety. So you'll find yourself vibrating and sensitive and fragile and wired towards safety. So this feels like a fundamental innocence of heart, that beneath all of our strategies, all of our behaviors, all of our defense mechanisms, is this fundamental desire to simply survive and maintain our own safety. So when we feel this in ourselves, much of our defensiveness, I think, can melt, when we can come back to this innocence that simply wants its own safety. So instead of going to battle on the self, We can see the self as simply a protective mechanism that was designed to keep us safe and has simply outworn its usefulness as a governing system. But underneath that is simply an innocent heart that wants its own safety. So we don't need to go to battle with that protectiveness. But when we get very, very close to it, we find that it loosens and softens on its own, and we may start to glimpse something wider. So once again, we're coming more and more into something trustworthy, and we ourselves are becoming more trustworthy because we no longer have to be governed by this self-protective mechanism. I had a teacher tell me once, "Do you realize how much energy it's taking to continue to convince yourself that you're this small in spite of all of this?" So we really have to work in this human realm, the realm of the fragile heart that wants safety for itself, if we're going to be able to integrate our insights, if we're going to be able to express and truly be able to relate. We need to be able to operate on this very human level, because the heart starts emptying its defenses. Kitty Sorrow says, "If your emptiness is really empty, it's not emptiness, it's aversion." So the heart is more and more free to respond. When we can let our defenses down and we realize that we are in something trustworthy, that we can become more trustworthy, it's more free to respond because it's not caught up in its small strategies to stay safe. So when we come to a practice like metta, where we repeat to ourselves, "May I be happy, may I be safe, may I have ease of well-being," it's as though we're nourishing the heart directly. We're giving it what it most longs for. And it has a concentrating and unifying effect on the entire system. So metta, the word for friendship or goodwill, is also part of kalyanamitta. So it's the same spirit that has the harmonizing effect within the community. So the phrases and the practice of metta is one way of coming back to the fundamental longings of the heart and feeding it, of giving it exactly what it needs in a concentrated, direct way, so the system can unify around that. And we no longer need to be caught up in our strategies of safety. So we find ourselves getting much wider. And then the Brahma Viharas become natural expressions of an open heart. So we find that when we encounter pain in others, we naturally respond more and more with compassion. And when we encounter the joy of others, the good fortune, we more naturally respond with our own sense of appreciation and gratitude. So it's as though the whole thing gets a little bit lighter, and we don't have to take it quite as seriously because something in us is coming into a more natural sense of integrity, being able to respond to the conditions around it from a less protective and defensive place. So we can get much wider. It's said that we have the capacity to develop a mind so filled with love that it resembles space. And that space cannot be marred by whatever's put into it. So you can fling anything into open space and it's not ultimately damaged or affected. So the heart can open that wide. And similarly, we can develop a mind filled with love that it resembles a river, that no matter what you throw into it, whatever fire you throw into it, it can't be burned. So similarly, there's this very indestructible quality when you start to widen and open the heart. Tiwari wrote a beautiful article in the newsletter about the power of the Brahmaviharas in her own practice, and she's speaking about it quite a lot in many of her classes. And she talks about the moment at which she realized that the Brahmaviharas weren't just a sidebar practice, weren't just a compliment meant to sort of lighten the mood, but that they're really could be a power behind much of the insight practice. So it can really be the energy that drives the seeing. So our practice can work in both directions. We can really soften and widen the heart in order to see more clearly and understand. And we can look more deeply in order that the heart can soften. So we really work in both directions. And so more and more this internal aspect of Sangha is coming to life in us. So it's said that those who take the three refuges and who maintain the five precepts become part of a field of merit or a field of blessing. So these are said to be not just restraints that we put on ourselves, but actually then our energies can align and we can become, our life really becomes more of a gift. They're said to be acts of generosity. We're giving the gift of harmlessness to other people. And I think Deepama is a real example of a life that has become, that became sort of a stream of blessing. So she's one of the only acknowledged female Buddhist masters in this lineage and was said to be the embodiment of both emptiness and loving kindness. And really made a big impact on many of the Western teachers who are teaching now, because her entire presence and being was described as sort of this field of loving kindness or this field of blessing. So this is a story of her life from Amy Schmidt. Deepama taught that the mind is not an enemy to be gotten rid of. Rather, in the process of befriending the mind and getting to know and accept it, it ceases to be a problem. Deepama knew the freedom that follows that process. She lived in a state of thought-free awareness. In a group interview, Jack Kornfield innocently asked, "What is it like in your mind?" Deepama smiled, closed her eyes, and quietly answered, "In my mind there are three things: concentration, loving-kindness, and peace." Jack, not sure if he had heard correctly, asked, "Is that all?" "Yes, that is all," Deepama replied. The room was silent. There were a few sighs and quiet laughs, followed by Jack's barely audible whisper, "How wonderful." So she was one of the first people that they did brain research on, and she showed to have an integrated, a level of integration that they hadn't seen before. as though all of the systems in her body were cooperating. The limbic system, the nervous system, her motor system, everything was coordinated. And they're able to show this more and more now with the research that's being done, that what happens is our systems come into more sense of harmony. And there's a sense of natural well-being that is extraordinarily possible. So traditionally it's said that only those who have attained a certain degree of enlightenment or who have entered the stream are those who are truly part of the noble Sangha. The Sangha that we can rely on for refuge, that we can use as a model for our behavior. But Stephen Batchelor has a different view of this. He has a different perspective. And he sees this entering the stream, he sees the stream as the Eightfold Path. So when he reads the text, he sees that the stream is really the Eightfold Path, and it's alive and created moment by moment. And so somebody who's entered the stream is someone who has made the Eightfold Path their own and truly internalized it. So he says, what is a stream enterer? One who owns or possesses the Eightfold Path is a stream enterer. One who is creating or cultivating the path. Who possesses the Eightfold Path? To possess something means it becomes your own. You own it. It is no longer something that you've borrowed. It's no longer something that you've misappropriated. It's become your own. What this points to at this point in your life is that your path is no longer something you have to learn about from some outward authority figure and approximate, but it's actually become part of the current of your existence. It's become your own. It's something that now lives with you, something that unfolds within you. So this is truly where the external has become internal. It's become part of who we are, of how we see the world, and of how we respond to the world. So in Rodney's terms, it would be a complete paradigm shift. And in this becoming part of the current of your existence, it feels as though then we actually feel ourselves to be part of the larger current of existence. And this can be experienced moment to moment. We have less and less of a concern as to how do I keep this little one safe and protected. And more there's a feeling of how can I get out of the way enough to let this move however it wants to move, and how can I nourish this movement in whatever way it needs to be nourished. So this is immediately available here and now. So we nourish it by noticing these capacities. So it's spring, it's the first day of spring, and many people planting seeds of intention, and refuge has a lot to do with setting our intention. So it's how do we nourish these seeds of potential within us? What's truly nourishing? And it starts by acknowledging what's there. So acknowledging the ease that's there, acknowledging the natural wakefulness and intelligence that's there, and the capacity for full awakening and full understanding. And so then we can enjoy it. We can enjoy being part of a natural process. We can participate in it fully. We can express it to others and help others to express it in their own way. So it really is though, when we take refuge in external Sangha, we're allowing, or each of us, allowing the external conditions to support each of our own individual awakening. So even though we each of us have to individually do the work and walk the path and develop our own understanding, it's the external Sangha to a large degree that allows for our each of our individual ripening and maturing. So then we have something to offer, and we become part of the Sangha forever. So thank you for your kind attention. Yes.